So the Arche to Arc is a almost 300-mile continuous triathlon. It's from the Marble Arch in London to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. You start by running from the Marble Arch to Dover, and that's 87 miles run. Then the swim across the English Channel, and then 290 kilometres, about 180 miles cycle to Paris. That's what I'm going to be attempting in September this year.
Welcome, Endurance Enthusiasts. I'm your host, Bruna.
And I'm your host, Fabi. You're tuning into Human Endurance, the podcast where we aim to inspire you with stories of achievement, motivation, and self-fulfillment.
We'll connect you with humans pushing boundaries, breaking barriers, and discovering the joy of endurance sports.
Join us on this journey of self-reflection and personal growth. Let's go the distance together.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to Human Endurance. Today, we have the opportunity to speak to the fascinating endurance athlete, Paul Robinson. He has done not only full distance triathlons, but also marathons, ultra marathons, and even channel swims. Here are some stats about him. Paul has completed 3 full Ironman races with a personal best at Ironman Copenhagen in 2023 with a finishing time of 10 hours and 56 minutes. He has run more than 20 marathons and ultra marathons. Here noteworthy is the London Marathon in 2023, finishing with a personal best of 3 hours and 16 minutes. Paul also has completed 3 swims across the English Channel. First in 2010 as a 3-person relay, then in 2012 as a 2-person relay, and then in 2020 he did it solo in 13 hours. Crazy! Can't wait to dive into this challenge. This year, Paul has set the ultimate challenge. He aims to complete the Arch to Arc. This is an endurance triathlon starting in London. He starts at the Marble Arch and runs 140 kilometers or 87 miles to Dover in the south of the UK. Then he swims the English Channel for 33 kilometers or 21 miles. And then he will cycle 290 kilometers or 181 miles to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. This is insane, Paul. On top of his endurance accomplishments, Paul also holds a PhD in chemistry from Loughborough University and works as a global strategic markets manager. He's also husband and father to Isabel, 13 years old, and Felicity, 11 years old. I'm very impressed and excited to have Paul here today at Human Endurance. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome, super excited to be speaking to you today.
Me too. As I said to you, this is the first time I've listened to podcasts. It's fun to be one of your episodes.
Excited to dive into your great achievements. Before we jump into it, one thing that I'm curious about is if endurance sports or just sports in general has always been part of your life.
So I was in a sporty family from a young age. So I did my first triathlon at 9 years old. It was my dad that got me into triathlon back in the days of Airborough Triathlon Club, which was a small local tri club. And it was in the early 90s, so triathlon wasn't that big back then. And I remember going into school and telling my mates who've been playing football, I've done this triathlon. And they're like, what the heck's a triathlon? So first of all, you had to explain it back then. So yeah, I trained in a triathlon club with my dad and some of his friends, probably from my early teens, mid-teens. And you just got used to seeing what some of these people were doing in terms of the longer races. And to me, it became an aspirational thing to start doing longer distance running. And then eventually that's grown into doing longer distance triathlons over the years. But yeah, one of my first memories was probably going to see two of my dad's friends, Tim Ashelford and Paul Freeman. This was before the days of the Ironman branded races in the UK. So it was an Ironman distance race, an iron distance race called The Longest Day. And my dad and I went down, I think it was in 1997, we went down to watch them for the day. And it was a hell of a day just even watching these two mates race a full distance. I guess that stuck in my mind. I was 14 years old back then. So 25 years later, I'm now 40. And yeah, this bug has stuck with me right from watching triathlon from a young age. I've really got the endurance bug now.
Ah, so cool. So you're really, I think, the first person I have met that started with triathlon, because usually you start with one of the sports, yeah. Right? So you're right from the get-go doing all the three of them.
Yeah, it was in the days where blokes would race the whole triathlon in a pair of like bright pink or orange speedos. You Google some of the images back then, and it was really the early days of triathlon. Some interesting bike choices, interesting attire to race in. It's funny looking back.
Things have changed a lot, right? The technology just exploded, I feel, in the last few years. And obviously participation in the sport as well. Like you said, nobody really knew what triathlon was, and not a lot of people were doing it. That must have been cool for you to been there, to have been there since the start and seen it develop.
Yeah, it was really cool. I've just got really fond memories of growing up and going away for weekends with my father, watching him and his friends race. Sometimes if it was shorter distance races, we could do them together. But Ironbridge is a nice town in England, and there's a famous Ironbridge there. And we'd go down for the weekend and there'd be a big party on the bridge afterwards. So that was another fond memory. It wasn't until, I think, 2000 when triathlon got into the Olympics. I think it was the Sydney Olympics, when it really started to grow. And then maybe in the UK, the Brownlee brothers have been massive in the sport, and they've been a really good advert for the sport. And it's really booming in the UK and I think globally, which is cool to see, especially when you got in the early days and when it used to go into school and say, I've done a triathlon, and people didn't know what that was back then.
Oh, wow. And now these days, triathlon is growing and growing as a sport. So nice to see how those things changed. Paul, can you maybe elaborate a bit on those days when you started doing triathlon? How was it for you getting into the sport? And did you already race competitively?
Yeah, my parents were separated, and it was a way of getting away for a weekend with my dad. But my whole family, I've got a brother and sister, and we used to do a lot that revolved around sports. So the whole family were rather sporty. As for school, there wasn't any specific triathlon clubs for children back then, not that I recall anyway. So the things that I used to do at school and I used to love were like the school cross country, keeping my running up. I was never a pool swimmer, so I never swam like at county level and in the inter-school championships, but I did enjoy training with those guys. Triathlon at the age of 9 was, I think it was Ampleforth Triathlon in Northern England, and it was so long ago, I can't really remember that well. I can remember the bike that I had at the time. It was a gold racing bike that my dad had bought me in the sale from somewhere. I can't remember what brand it was, but yeah, you were racing on old closed roads and there were speed bumps on the cycle course for young kids. So that was my first triathlon at the age of 9. And then sport was just really part of my life as a kid. So as I grew up through my teenage years, I guess there wasn't as many rules in place as there is today about kids competing with adults. So I can remember racing in the inter-club cross-country leagues from quite a young age. And that was without adults. And then I grew up doing triathlons, and my dad was actually the chairman of the local tri club. So it was Airborough Triathlon Club, which is now Leeds and Bradford, which is two quite large cities in the northern UK. So my dad was a chairman of the club, and he helped organise with the other club members a local triathlon that was really well known, Ilkley Triathlon. And I think most of the family raced in that every year. I can remember my dad doing it, my brothers doing it. And then, wider friends and family doing it. So that was a bit of an annual event in the family calendar. And then we'd also partake in marshalling and organising the event as well. So that was really cool.
And Paul, I'm curious to hear like how your relationship to the sport has changed over time. Do you remember what your motivation was like back then? And I'm curious if it has changed to what motivates you to keep doing the sport today.
I've always just done the sport for the fun and the camaraderie. So I think that's something that I learned from that group of people in Leeds and Bradford Tri way back in the 90s. We're doing this sport for fun. We'll go and have a drink and some food afterwards. And it was really just for fun. So I never really wanted to be a highly competitive athlete. It was more the social aspect for me. That's still fairly true today, 25, 26 years later. I still do the sport for fun. I love the social aspect, and I'm a member of two local triathlon clubs in Nottingham, TFN and Nottingham Tri Club, and I love training with those guys, just seeing other people do well and see how they go on their triathlon journey.
I also like that you mentioned the social aspect of triathlon, because in the end it is an individual sport, but you do meet a lot of people along the journey in training and in clubs, so I think it's a good thing to mention the social aspect of the sport.
Yeah, after my teenage years of growing up doing triathlons in Leeds, that's where I grew up, I moved to Loughborough University in the Midlands. And Loughborough, for those people in the UK, people will know that's a really sporty university. It's renowned for sport. You swim in alongside Olympians, really high-class athletes. There's amazing swimming pool gyms and other facilities. So at university, I met a lot of people who were big into the sport. So I was studying for chemistry, but the sport was really my way of relaxing after studying, and also meeting new people and socializing with those people as part of the university culture.
So cool. So did the university recruit specifically athletes to compete for them, or how does that work?
Yeah, I bet they did. I bet they were trying to recruit the highest athletes, the highest talented athletes. I never looked into that because I was always just doing it for fun, but there must have been quite a few bursaries there for high potential athletes, because you were training alongside people who were going to the Olympics. So I went from my local tri club in Leeds, swimming in one of the faster lanes, to Loughborough University tri club, thinking, oh, I'll still be a decent level of athlete. And then you quickly realize, no, you move into the slower lanes, there's potential Olympians that you're going to be training with. So that was an interesting experience, but it never harmed my relationship with triathlon, because my mindset was always, I enjoyed my sciences, I was studying chemistry, and this was really an extra activity that I was doing just to keep fit and be sociable, the triathlon piece.
Before we go to your big challenge that you're planning out this year, I want to dive a bit into your journey towards setting this big goal, right? Because and I know it from being an endurance athlete as well. You start with half marathon, or maybe you started directly with the marathon, and then you always want more, or what else can I do, and new challenge. And yeah, let's start with your running experiences. So you've ran more than 20 marathons and ultra marathons, and you did last year your PB in the London Marathon with 3 hours, 16 minutes. Can you tell us a bit more about your running experiences and having run so many races? What does running mean to you and bring to your life?
Yeah, sure. I worked in a running shop as well growing up. So a little local running shop, probably from the age of 16, 17. I think I was studying for my A-levels just before university. And I remember one of the first kind of distance races I did back then was a half marathon, again, with my dad and some friends from a local tri club. And I remember the owner of the shop was a really well-renowned runner. And he was like, a half marathon's too far for a kid who's 16. But we went away for the weekend. We camped. We did the race. And I just loved it. And that challenge of going further has always been a part of who I am. You then go on through the years. And I was at Charnwood Running Club. So after I'd finished my undergraduate degree, I joined Charnwood Running Club, and people were talking about entering the London Marathon ballot. So I entered the ballot and didn't get in. It's very difficult to get into London. But I was like, no, I really want to do a marathon now. So that was, early 20s. And I did Leicester Marathon as my first one in 2008. And I thought I got fit at the time, but I probably, knowing what I know now, 15 years later, I probably didn't train prop for that marathon. And after 20 miles, I was completely dead.
Do you remember how were you training at that time?
I can't remember how much I was training, but I was still, I'd moved on from studying my undergrad to studying my PhD. So I was still fitting in running training around a lot of lab work and research. And then I've always been quite a social person, so probably heavy on the social side still. Although I enjoyed running, I probably wasn't doing anywhere near as much as I should have been doing for my first marathon.
And also back in the day, Did you even use a stopwatch or something similar?
Don't think we did. I can't remember what years those things that you started to wear on your arm was, but my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, I remember having this big arm strap on with a huge GPS device. So it was, I'm pretty sure it was in the days before GPS watches.
Yeah, so you probably just went out for a run, not really tracking the kilometers and building up the mileage and then tapering and all of those things, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. I quite often do like out and back courses, so at least I could go on Google Maps and plot out the route, and then I could use my trusty Timex watch and time roughly what minute mile pace I was doing. But yeah, I don't think I had a GPS watch back then, so it made it a bit trickier.
Yeah, things have gotten easier.
Let's go back to your marathon experiences, because you mentioned before that you started running your first marathon. And then eventually last year, you managed to do your personal best. Can you elaborate a bit on this journey? Was your goal to become faster in the marathon, or how did this evolve over time?
I think I've done 16 road marathons, plus quite a few ultras. But marathon-wise, I've had a bug for many years, and that's really been my father's PB at the marathon distance. That at any family gatherings or parties, he's reminded me of his PB for... must be 15, 20 years. And it was, I can't remember exactly, I think it was 3:18, 3:19. So I have been chasing that marathon time since 2008. So it was a 15-year journey chasing his marathon PB, just so I can stop him mentioning it at family gatherings.
I love it. So it was all for the Christmas party.
Yeah. So he still winds me up about there's a few other family records that he's got in swimming, 5K, which I'm not sure I'm ever going to be. He was a good swimmer as well. So I was really pleased last year to knock off the family marathon record. But yeah, it took me 16 marathons, and there were some painful experiences during those 16 marathons. I had some really good runs and some not so good runs where I was underprepared and probably did too much socializing in the run up to some of those races.
Okay, so the main goal was always to chase the PB of your dad, I guess. And then you were like, I need a new challenge.
I guess so, but I genuinely do love marathons. I just think the atmosphere, and I've run many marathons with groups of friends. It's just a nice thing to, at the end of the year in the autumn, you're wondering, oh, what goals shall I set for next year at the end of the triathlon season? So there's been many times when I've spoke to friends and said, yes, we'll do this spring marathon together and we'll all set our individual goals, and then it keeps you motivated through the winter. So yeah, I was chasing my father's PB, but I've still got a genuine love of doing a marathon, and particularly like big city marathons. So as I've got older, I've liked to travel a bit more, and I did Amsterdam Marathon a few years ago. It was a lad's weekend away. So a lad's weekend now has gone from going away drinking to we go away and we do a marathon together. And yeah, we have a few beers after. And then last year I did Valencia. And Valencia, beautiful city, and we had a long weekend there. And that was a really great marathon as well, which seems to be really up and coming in Spain.
It's a very fast one, right? The Valencia, it's getting very popular.
It's really flat, really fast. So yeah, I enjoyed that. It wasn't near my PB. I think I'd had a few niggles injury-wise in the lead up to that, but I think I did around 340, 345, something like that. And yeah, we had a good weekend. And I think my mate went very close to 3 hours. So he was pleased as well.
I love this. I don't know if I call it a strategy, but this way of seeing marathons as a way to travel and experience the world and have fun with friends. That's definitely something that I abide to. I've gathered friends to go to Ibiza to run a half marathon, which is, some people that don't run were like, what are you doing in Ibiza? You're running? That doesn't make any sense. But for me, it was the perfect kind of trip. This year, we're planning to go to Vienna. I was training for it, unfortunately got injured, but there's still a big group. I'm still going to go. Fabi's going to go. We're going to go support everybody. And I just find it like just the best time. Like you said, you train, like keeps people motivated throughout winter. You get to train, you get to run, and then you celebrate together with beers. And I find that moment post-marathon just to be the most enjoyable, like, it's just mission accomplished, and now you can just be there with your friends. So can totally relate to that.
Yeah, So cool. And yeah, traveling Copenhagen Ironman, we went to, and we traveled with a family of four of us. And just, I look back, and you asked me earlier how I got into triathlon in the first place, and it was through my father. So my kids are traveling with us to go and see me do an Ironman in other countries. And I just really hope that one day they'll get the triathlon bug as well.
If you have a role model that's your parents, I think it's quite an easy way to get into it. And also you see how it's possible to do, and that's really nice.
Yeah, they think I'm completely mad, the distances that I do, but they've grown up seeing me do marathons from such a young age that they'll probably have a warped sense of reality that ultra marathons, Ironmans is just very normal, and that's what everybody does. So I'm happy if they grow up with that mindset.
Nice. Yeah, it's all about mindset, right, in the end. And you just mentioned the Copenhagen Ironman that you did last year as well, on top of the London Marathon. And there also you had your PB, so two PBs last year. Congratulations. You have done three full distance triathlons or Ironmans, which brings us closer to your big challenge that you're chasing now. And you just said that you brought your whole family there. How was this race for you? And you also had this amazing time of 10 hours, 56 minutes.
Oh, it was an amazing. We went there for the week. So we were in Copenhagen itself for 3 or 4 days. I was a bit nervous before the race because I trained quite hard. So I was putting a bit of pressure on myself. I wanted to do a PB. So probably the 3 days around the race was not the most fun for my family. I think they did have fun, but they knew that Dad was a little stressed. And then the 3 or 4 days afterwards, we chose a kid's water park to go to. So it was like little lodges on the west coast of Denmark. So the beach was nearby, and we just spent some time with the kids enjoying the water park and the beach and some nice food and drinks. So it was a really good week in Denmark. But yeah, the race itself, it was the first Ironman branded, a full Ironman that I'd done. And the experience was amazing. It's just so well organized, and you do get that extra little bit extra when you do an Ironman event. The swim was beautiful, and the water temperature was quite warm, so it was a beautiful swim. The cycle was suited me because it wasn't too hilly. I'm a little bit heavier than your average triathlete, so I try to pick courses that are a bit flatter, but this was described as rolling, and yeah, there's a lot of flat sections where you could get down on the tri bars and settle in. But I'm not quite at that level where I could do a whole 112 miles in the TT position. I need to stretch my back off. The hills and the rolling countryside allowed you to get out of the saddle. And so I really enjoyed the bike course as well. And then the other thing that I liked about it was a 4-lap run. And some people love that, some people hate that, but I love it because you can just tick them off one at a time. I don't actually think about running a marathon. I just think about it's 4 10Ks. The first lap of the run on the Ironman, my wife and two daughters were stood there on the side, and I was over the moon. I knew that I was on for a PB if I kept running at the speed I was on. So I took probably 5 or 10 seconds to kiss them all as I ran past, and a little delay, but said hi and thanks for the support. And then gradually through the race, every time I ran past, I got more and more miserable as the pain settled in. And so I think the second lap wasn't too bad. The third got worse. And then, yeah, I think I barely spoke after that. My wife could just tell that I was in agony, and I was pushing hard to try and get sub 11 hours.
What was your PB before that one?
11:29.
Okay, it was a massive PB.
Yes, I tried to set like several targets. A friend of mine told me to do this rather than just setting one target for a race where if the conditions or you have an injury in the lead up affect the run up, set three targets. So I think for Copenhagen, I was like, I wanted to be under 12 hours was my bronze. Then a PB under 11:29 was my silver. And then secretly, I didn't tell anyone of this at the time, but I was like, I'm sure I'm capable of a sub 11. So that was my gold target. So I knew I was really close to it. And the last lap, I was just doing the maths. Like what, looking at my GPS watch, trying to figure out what minute miling I was running and whether I was going to sneak under 11 hours. And yeah, it was a painful last lap.
I can imagine.
How fast did you run each one of the splits? I'm curious.
Not sure. I'm not sure about the splits for each lap, but my watch at the start was telling me The problem is there's high buildings as well, so you lose GPS. So at one point, I'm sure it was telling me I was running like 7:45 minute miles, which is like way too fast for me. And I'll never know.
4:40, I think, per kilometer or so.
Yeah, so I'll never know whether I set off way too fast or whether that was just the high-rise buildings. But yeah, I definitely slowed towards the end. I think towards the end, I think it was 10-minute miling. But run walking through the aid stations. It was quite a warm day. It was good for spectators, but not good for me. Just trying to keep hydrated with the electrolytes and take on some gels. So yeah, walk the aid stations and then run. And there's quite a lot of it. There's quite a lot of aid stations. I think there were every kilometre. It was, psychologically, it was good because, yeah, kilometres not very far. So you just get to the next aid station, have another drink and just continue and just keep checking your watch and see if you're on for the time you want. So it was good.
What was your final time for the marathon in this the Copenhagen marathon?
It was around 4:10. I was a bit disappointed with that because, I'd set myself a target of getting under 4 hours.
I'm training now also for a full Ironman, and I think it's hard for me personally. I don't have a time goal. I do have maybe goals for each discipline, but then in the run, I feel like anything can happen because it's so unpredictable how you're going to feel after the bike, because also you've never done it. I've never done it. I think it's very challenging to pull off a good run at the end of all of that.
Yeah, I think for your first one, I probably did have some secret time targets in my mind for my first one. I think I did that in 2016, but I'd say just try and enjoy it, the first one, because as you say, the run in particular, it really depends on how things go on the bike. Did you manage to stay hydrated? Did you eat enough? I tried to treat the bike as a bit of a picnic on wheels, and then the run in theory should be a little more fun, but it's always going to be painful running a marathon after a 112-mile bike.
Yeah, it should be painful in the end, right? Otherwise, you could have pushed more.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a mindset. Paul, I'd love to move on and talk about your English Channel challenges that you've done. For our listeners to understand, the English Channel is 21 miles or 33 kilometers long, correct?
Yeah.
And however, we know that oftentimes when doing these swims, the distance can be a little longer because of currents and you can't really swim in a straight line, right? So it's on average a little bit longer than 32 kilometers.
Sure. Yeah, it depends what tide you're on. And I think the last time I swam the channel, it was more like 45 kilometers. But you can't really claim you swam that because a lot of it's tide assisted. But yeah, it's about 33 kilometers across in a straight line.
Fascinating. That sounds just mind-boggling to me. Can you first walk us through what motivated you to take on this challenge, first as a relay and then solo?
So again, to me, it goes back to childhood. And my father's asked me this: why did you think this was a good idea to try and swim the channel? And it's hard to remember, but I think somebody bought me a Guinness Book of Records, a world records book, as a kid. And I'm sure reading that at a very young age, there was something in one of those books about swimming the English Channel. And again, it's just something that stuck in my mind. And all these years later, that seems like a good challenge. And so it was 2008. I'd graduated. I'd left Loughborough University with my PhD and got my first job out of university. And my first month's paycheck came in. And I was like, I know what I want to do. Because it's quite an expensive thing to do, swimming the channel. You need the pilot boat and all the registration fees that go with it. So literally as soon as I started my first job out of university, I contacted the Channel Swimming and Pilot Federation, booked a slot, and it was a 2-year wait. So I booked a slot for 2010. And my original plan was to do it solo.
Just do it from the start solo. Wow.
Yeah, that was my original plan. I've done this a few times over the years. I've booked onto races after a few beers and a bit over exuberant. So that was probably one of them. I'd booked onto a channel swim, not really thinking about it too much. And then as time went by and I started training, I was like, oh man, this is a long way. This is going to be harder than I thought. And I think the other thing is work life picked up, just started a new job and I was trying to give that my all. And I can't really remember the logic. My wife may have played some part in that as well, but I decided to turn it into a relay, with a 3-man relay. and I recruited two good friends of mine to do it as a channel relay. I'm really glad I did that looking back, because it may have been a step too far, who knows, in a new job, and I didn't have that much experience of real long distance swimming. I love sea swimming, but who knows whether I'll have made it across. So we did it as a three-man relay, and we made it across in, I think it was around 12 and a half hours, and it was a great experience. So anybody who's thinking about swimming the channel one day, I really highly recommend they do a channel relay first, because it does give you a taste of what swimming in that sea is like, some of the considerations about the escort boat, feeding, and how long it really takes, just the reality of it. So it's a great experience just doing a channel relay to start with. Mm.
And how does it work, the logistics of it even? So you said you have to kind of book your slot. And I also assume you cannot do this all year round, because in wintertime it's too cold. So do you have a specific time window also where ships are not crossing the channel at the same time? And how do the logistics work of that?
Yeah, so in terms of the channel swimming window, it always used to be the summer months, but people have started pushing the boundaries now. I can't tell you the exact dates, but I've seen stories of people doing it through the winter months. They're the really rare exceptions. I think just in the last few months, I think a team did a channel relay, and it was something crazy like 10 degrees. It may have even below 10 degrees. But for most normal people like me, you choose to swim the channel in the summer. And I think probably from June time till late September. And it's all about what phase the moon's in to where the tides are. So it's a neap or spring tide. And there's a certain number of pilot boats that are approved to take people across the channel swimming. And they book up 2, sometimes 3 years in advance. So you book a weather window. I think it's around 6 or 7 days a tide. And you can be slot 1, 2, 3, or 4. And you just wait. So when your slot arrives, you just wait for the wind to drop and the weather to be okay. And you wait for the phone call from the pilot boat telling you it's time to go. So you tend to get 24-hour notice if you're lucky.
And do you need to provide some proof of that you're capable of doing it? Or could anybody just book this boat?
Yeah, so there's two. There's a Channel Swimming and Pilot Federation, and then there's the Channel Swimming Association. So there's two associations and federations that register people for doing the channel. And yeah, both of them, I think you need to have a 6-hour swim in less than 16 degrees C water. So that's the qualifying swim, and that's non-wetsuit.
How do you go about proving that? I guess, do you go swim and then you just say, hey, I did it? Or does it have to be an official thing?
No, you've got to get someone to sign it off. So in the past, I've had like a coach, or there's a group on Dover Beach, Dover Channel Training. So they meet on Dover Beach most weekends through the summer. And I've done my qualifying swim with those guys before. So you go down there and you register, you pay a small fee to register with them. They'll look after your kit and feed you every hour whilst you swim in laps of the harbour. And then the lady or whoever's organising it that weekend will sign off your 6-hour swim. If you stayed in there for 6 hours, you're not allowed to get out at any point. And then also they'll measure the temperature of the water, and it's got to be under 16 degrees C.
Okay, pretty strict.
Guess you could fake it, but it'd be crazy to do that, because for me, even a 6-hour swim in that temperature is not enough. That's really the bare minimum. When I was training for my solo swim, I did a 11 or 12 hour swim. So that would be my advice to anyone for training for the channel. Go much longer than the 6 hours in 16 degrees. So it's such an expensive thing to do that you don't want to risk not making it across.
How much is it approximately to do that?
I think it's probably £3,500 now for the pilot boat. And then you've got all the fees on top of that. Yeah, it's an expensive hobby.
Wow.
First time I hear something more expensive than Ironman.
Yeah, so that's the selling point for when I tell my wife I'm doing another Ironman. I can say it's a very cheap hobby in comparison to channel swimming.
And can you walk us a bit through this, the swim itself? So you said, so the channel swim, right, you do in the wetsuit, or you also do without?
No, without a wetsuit. So yeah, it's mandated that you do it without a wetsuit, upholding the traditions of channel swimming. So Yeah, no wetsuits allowed. You're only allowed one swim cap as well. You're not allowed a thick neoprene swim cap. And yeah, when I did my first relay in 2010, there was three of us. So two guys on the bow, and then I started. And then we just rotated round. I did an hour. Then the next one jumped in, did an hour. Meanwhile, I'm on the boat. I get 2 hours rest. And 2 hours rest sounds like a long time. But when you're on a moving boat that's just bobbing around at two knots, 2 miles an hour, it's not really moving how the boat's designed to do. So it's just bobbing in the water. And it's not a very nice motion. It gives you seasickness. So you're trying to then feed, eat and drink. But it's not fun, so that takes some practice as well.
Wow. And do you also get seasick in the water? Because I've swam on a race in rough water where, you know, you're like, your head is down and your body is up, and I felt a bit nauseous too. Do you get that as well there?
Personally, I don't, but I've heard friends and people I've met in Dover training complain of seasickness. And it could be to do with your ears, and you get cold water in your ears. So one of the things that I do now is I just breathe to my right-hand side. So I've always had problems with my right ear because of the cold water swimming. So I've had an earplug specially made just to block my right ear, and that stopped all of the ear problems that I used to have. And yeah, I don't get seasickness or anything like that. So people who do get seasickness, I think earplugs are a good first thing to try. And you can just buy the cheap ones off the shelf to start with.
Oh, I didn't know about that. That's a good tip. And how does the relay work? Are you free to figure out between your group, like how you're going to split the swimming time?
It's a long time ago now, but I think the rules were that you had to do 1 hour on and then through the group of you. So I think a standard relay swim is six people. We chose to do it as three the first time, and we just went through 1 hour, 1 hour, 1 hour. And then it was quite lucky because I said I started the swim in Dover, and just purely by chance, because it was 12 and a half hours when we landed in France, I got to finish as well. So that was a really cool experience. And then for the two-man relay that I did in 2012, I think for that one, we got the option of 1 hour on, 1 hour off. But we knew from the prior experience that 1 hour off would not be... It's very hard to get dry, get warm, and get fed and drink some liquids within an hour and then get ready to get back in. For that, I think the two man we got to choose, and we chose 2 hours on, 2 hours off, which worked better. But I swear that one took us 16 hours or something. And I was a stronger swimmer, and the lady who was my swim partner that year was a really strong swimmer as well. And it took us longer. So it just shows you that the conditions in the channel can affect the time massively.
How was then the solo swim? And also, just before you start, I know somebody who swims channels as well, like the Seven Waters, and he actually told me that before you enter the water, you have to put some cream on your body because of the sea, because it will affect your skin otherwise. Is that true? Do you have to put like a layer of Vaseline or whatever it is?
Yeah, there's all kinds of like old wives' tales about lotion or grease you should put on. And I think there's been tales of using sheep's fat and stuff. And I just simply use Vaseline. I don't know whether that brand exists on the continent, but it's just grease, basically. And yeah, you get to know where the parts of your body are that rub during those training swims in Dover. And it is different in salt water, places that you don't think would rub, like the back of your neck, just from sighting. So you gradually learn as you build up your hours and hours of swimming, and then you just start applying more and more grease to those areas, and eventually you find a solution that works. But yeah, it's nothing fancy, just all petroleum jelly that I use.
And how do you go about doing this solo? Do you stop to drink and eat?
So the relays were relatively easy from that point of view, because you wouldn't stop for the whole hour. You'd just swim through and then you'd eat and drink back on the boat. The added complication of the solo swims is that you've got to eat and drink in the sea, and you're not allowed to touch the boat, that you'd be disqualified if you touch the boat. So that adds an added complication. And what we use and other channel swimmers use is, it almost looks like a fishing reel. And we attached like a protein shake bottle, and that had my carb drink and electrolyte in it. So that would be thrown overboard to me. So the boat would hold up a sign, 5 minutes until you feed. So I'd know that it was coming and I'd move slightly closer to the boat to swim alongside. And then gradually my father was on the boat and one of my best friends, Sam, and one of those would throw the drinks bottle over the side. I'd catch it and then just tread water, try and drink 500 mil of carb and electrolyte drink as fast as humanly possible because you're drifting. The currents are so quick that you're just drifting away from the boat. So ideally, you need to feed in 30 seconds. That's probably taking more like a minute.
Wow, especially because you're horizontal, and I don't know if people that listen ever tried to eat or drink horizontally, but it's not easy.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to practice again in training. So that's another important reason to go down to the sea and get used to taking on more and more liquids and foods. And it's different for everybody. When I was training for the Channel in 2019 with a friend, we'd turn up at the beach and I'd have a full picnic bag for the day because I'm never sure what I'd like to eat. It might be bananas, chocolate rolls, energy gels, and then mini flapjack bites, the like little breakfast bar type things. So I'd turn up at the beach with a bag that could feed a family of four for a week. And my friend was the opposite end of the spectrum. He turned up with 1 liter bottle of juice that was like highly concentrated carbohydrate drink, and he was going to use that for a whole of his 6 hour swim. So it just shows you. The coach on the beach that weekend laughed at us and he was shaking his head at us both. My friend had far too little and I had far too much, but it just shows you. He's a successful Channel swimmer as well, and you've got to find out what works for you.
This is fascinating. And Paul, I assume you swam through daylight, right?
That was another one of the things I was a bit worried about, but I just put to the back of my mind. But like I was saying with the, you get a Channel swim window, but you don't know when your start date is going to be, and you don't know when your start time is going to be. It all depends on what's the weather doing, predominantly the wind, because the wind kicks up waves, and you don't want that for 12, 15 hours. So I got the call for my solo Channel swim. And I remember him saying, meet at the boat at midnight. I was like, oh, man. So I've never done much swimming in the dark. When you've been training, I trained for 2 years for this because I trained in 2019 and the weather didn't happen. So I had to train for a second year. So I trained 1 year. The swim got cancelled. I trained a second year. So when eventually he called me down and said, it's a midnight meet, you're going to be in the water, start swimming at 1 a.m. Part of me was absolutely petrified of swimming in the pitch black in the sea, but part of me was like really excited that this is finally going to happen after a 2 year wait.
Wow. And I imagine you have like this lane, right? So you know where you're swimming, so you don't have to sight necessarily, right?
You aim to swim alongside the boat. So the boat's lit up, and it had the boat that I was with, the support boat, had a spotlight on me. So you can stay alongside the boat, and the idea is that you don't look where you're going. You just keep your head down, and every time I breathe to my right, so I had the boat to my right, and you're just trying to stay the same distance, maybe 5 meters away from the boat, and just stay that same distance. Interestingly, and you learn this from the relays, the boat has these GPS systems. It's plotting a graph of where you're heading versus where the tide's taking you, and it's not the same. So the boat might be heading in one direction, but the tide and your swimming's taking you in another. So it's quite a complex task on the boat, them calculating how fast you're swimming, where the tide's taking you. And you end up traveling in this huge S shape across the English Channel, which adds miles and miles on.
This sounds so difficult. Were you ever scared during your swim?
I guess it was a shock. And what I do remember is the shock of jumping into the sea at night. I wouldn't say that I enjoy swimming in the dark, and I don't like, nobody likes being stung by jellyfish, but yeah, I've been stung by a fair few jellyfish, and it's nice to be able to spot them, particularly the ones in the English Channel. They're quite big. You can spot them in the daylight and just swim around them. But that was my main concern. It's like swimming in the night, you could just swim head on into a jellyfish, and that was the main fear for me.
Don't see them, yeah.
What about sharks? Is that scary? That would be what I would be scared about.
Loads of people say that to me, of all about sharks, but I don't think there's any sharks that are going to eat you in the English Channel. I think it's too cold.
You took 13 hours to swim, and I imagine you start off and you're fresh, and then after maybe 3-4 hours, I guess, you're getting a bit tired or also a bit bored. How do you mentally cope with swimming for so long? And you said that you're also breathing to the right, so I assume you also get stiff neck, everything hurts. How do you manage that mentally?
A good friend of mine, this was one of the best tips that I got, Jevon, his name is, he swam the channel the year before COVID, and he told me, you're starting at night, don't think about the whole, it's about mentally breaking things down again. He said, don't think about the full channel, swim to sunrise. So it was about 5 hours, I think, before the sun started to come up. And that was literally all I thought about. I was talking to myself in the water as I was swimming, telling to keep my stroke correct, high elbows, keep breathing, keep calm, keep the effort level correct. Swimming from feed to feed. So I was feeding every hour at that point. And then every time I was thinking, God, this is already, or this is boring, I was thinking, just swim to the sunrise. That's what he said to me. And yeah, it was pretty amazing. The sunrise over the English Channel, and it was a clear day and just the orange appearing. And yeah, at that point in time, you just feel really lucky, because who gets to experience swimming in the middle of the sea and the sun coming up, and you've got a pilot boat and a team of people on board supporting you trying to get to France. So that was pretty special. So that was a great tip from Jevon.
Amazing. What goes through your mind when you're in the middle of the channel and you see this?
So at that moment in time, it was probably relief, because I dreaded swimming through the night. So the fact that the sun came up, it was, yeah, like, just, oh, I'm a lucky person to be doing this. And you're 5 hours into something that you know is going to take a long time. So you've trained for that. Wasn't in too much pain, still swimming within myself, 5 hours in. And yeah, probably just really enjoyed that moment, and then knew that, I think I told myself at that point in time, probably the hardest part was over. And that turned out to be wrong. But at that point in time, I told myself the hardest part was over.
What happened afterwards? Did everything get more difficult, just like it does at the end of a marathon or an Ironman?
Yeah. So my memories, it's 4 years ago almost now, but my memories were that up to 10 hours swimming, I felt pretty good. And the boat, the team were really encouraging every feed, and I felt tired, but I didn't feel, you know, completely shot. So 10 hours in, secretly, I wanted to be around 11 hours. Most people who do channel swimming will tell you that the time doesn't even matter, because there's so many variables with the weather and the waves. Still secretly set myself a time that I wanted to hit. And we were going pretty well, and we'd just gone round the top of an S shape, and the tide had picked up and it was bringing us in towards France. I think I was swimming at something, I wasn't swimming at that speed, but it was like 4 knots, 5 knots we were traveling at. It was crazy. And the reason I could tell that was because my GPS watch was set to do 400 meter laps from the pool. So it just kept beeping every few minutes. And I was like, we are flying. So I knew that we were going really fast. But you come in down, not directly into the shore, but you're going across. So I was like, we're moving really quickly now. I still feel good. We're going to be on for, yeah, hopefully 11 hours. But as we got close to the Cap Grenet, the little bit of France that sticks out where people try to land, that was when the tide then turned. And I could see the piece of land. And I'm not joking, it didn't get any closer for what seemed like eternity. Said to you, I breathed to the right. So I had to keep looking up and sighting as though I was in a triathlon. I could see the land and the lighthouse on top. And it moved to my left for a while. And then it moved back to my right, and we didn't get any closer. So it was just staring at the same piece of land. And I've watched so many channel swims over the years. I knew exactly what had happened. That the tide had took us south past it. And then we turned and we were now going back past it on the north. Heading north.
That must be mentally super difficult, because it's what keeps you going always is one step forward or one stroke forward. But if you feel you see your aim, but you don't move forward, That must be super hard.
It was tough. It's like mentally really tough when you can see land, but you can't reach it. And I also knew from the response of the people on the boat, when they're telling you to swim harder. So by that point, I've been in over 11 hours swimming and they're going, swim harder, go faster. And it's like, I can't speed up at this point in time. Gradually watched Cap Grenet disappear to the right. And yeah, I've watched so many plots of Channel Swims. I knew that we were going to probably end up in the bay, which is a nice beach area to land, but it added about 2 hours onto my swim. So there's a point in time where you're going away from land and then the current kind of allows you to swim into the bay eventually.
And then how is that you get to the bay and you, I guess you're not just immediately stand up and you're like, I've done it. Your body must be super tired.
I was quite grumpy probably because I think it's this thing that I've waited most of my life to be able to swim to France. And I went through that roller coaster journey mentally of I wanted to hit 11 hours. I could see France and then it came and it disappeared again. And then it took 2 hours to swim into a bay. So it was like huge relief that actually I'd made it because there was points in that last few hours where I wasn't sure I was going to make it. But then also you're on a beach and it's the middle of summer and there's all the French tourists there. So there's nobody to celebrate with. So you're staggering up the beach. It's hard to walk after swimming for 13 hours. So you're staggering up the beach in a swim hat. There's a flashing light on your head and there's a load of people on the beach just enjoying the summer's day with the kids. So it was a little bit surreal.
They're probably like, who's this guy? Where is he coming from?
Did anybody reach out? Was anybody like, hey, what are you? Where did you come from?
It's probably one of my regrets. I probably didn't embrace that time enough. And I think there were some people that clapped me and understood what I'd done. And I think there was a few French people came over and we had a very brief discussion. And then all I did, which is traditional with channel swimming, is you pick up some pebbles, stick them down your trunks, and then they're the memento that you made it to France. So I grabbed three pebbles for my three girls and made my way back to the boat.
That's very cute. And you take the boat back to the UK?
Yeah, so I got on the boat and my dad was there with my best friend Sam and they were over the moon for me. But I was quite grumpy for probably 20 minutes, half an hour. And it's like a 2 hour boat ride back to Dover. And yeah, for a good while, I was quite grumpy at what had happened and I hadn't done the time that I wanted. And they even captured that on video, which is funny looking back at that now. And then eventually they popped open some bubbly and we had a glass of champagne each and I cheered up.
Difficult sometimes when you have an internal goal and even though you are achieving great things and there's stuff, something to be proud of. It's hard sometimes to cheer yourself up if you don't meet your goal. I've had to face that a few times. And I think it takes some maturity to be like, to stop bringing yourself down when that happens and really just embrace that you've managed. I mean, it's swimming the English Channel, that's just absolutely insane. It is the most incredible thing I've ever heard of. It sounds so difficult. I can't believe you did it at night. That just adds a whole other layer of, I don't know, like, it's just, wow, it's fascinating.
It was an amazing experience. And yeah, it was like a 10-year journey from that first channel relay swim in 2010. It took me 10 years to achieve the solo swim. So it was, yeah, a lot of relief. And then when it eventually soaked in, we had some good celebrations back home with friends and family. So I really enjoyed it.
It's so impressive that you were able to do that. It's very few people that managed to do to accomplish this crossing.
Yeah, I think the famous quote is there's something like 2,500 people swam the channel, and I think there's less people swam the channel than summited Everest is the quote. I don't know whether that's still true, but I've heard that quite a few times.
For sure, for sure. And I guess now we walked a bit through your different endurance challenges, and now you're trying to combine all of those in one big challenge, right? Which is the arch to arc challenge. And like you said previously in our conversation, you always want to go further and further. And I guess this challenge embodies this for you. How did you come up with this specific challenge? Because there's a lot of other challenges that you could do, like ultra marathons, other ultra endurance events, the Norseman Triathlon, for example, which is also a very hard triathlon. Why this specific challenge?
It's a difficult question to answer. Again, it's when something gets stuck in my head, it can lay there for many years, and then eventually I've got to scratch the itch. The Arch to Arc, the Enduroman Arch to Arc, I first saw on TV in the UK around 2012, and it was a guy called Mark Bayliss, and he set a rec for doing this event non-wetsuit. So that's 2012, so 12 years ago. And I just thought it was amazing. I think I watched the TV program several times, and I was just like, man, this is crazy. This is, you, not only are you swimming the channel, but you're also making it into a triathlon from London to Paris. So I think that's just stuck in my head for years. And yeah, Norseman is something that's on probably on my bucket list. And then there's a number of other Ironman races and ultra targets that I've got. But I think with where my fitness is at and where my strengths are really in the swimming, this is one that really fits my skill set at the moment. So my main bugbear with triathlon is the swim's not long enough. So if you're a good swimmer in triathlon, you're only in the water for an hour, whereas the cycle for me was 5.5 hours. So cycling's my least favourite out of the three, and I get to do it the most. So with the Arch to Arc, the swim's really a significant portion, and it gets me swimming the English Channel again as part of a much bigger challenge. So I'm really excited by it. But yeah, it was something that I saw on TV 12 years ago, and I'm just coming round to getting a slot. You've actually got to apply for a slot. There's only 10 slots a year. So the company that organises it take applications. You have to say what ultramarathons you've done, what long swims you've done, what triathlons. So there's an application process, and they vet people out. And it was, yeah, over a year ago now that I got the email just before Christmas 2023 saying you've been selected, and let us know in the next 2 weeks if you want to put your deposit down and have a slot for 2024. So I've bit the hand off.
Fascinating. Can you remind the listeners exactly what the Arch to Arc means?
So the Arch to Arc is almost 300-mile continuous triathlon. So it's from the Marble Arch in London to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. So it connects two big cities in Europe. You start by running from the Marble Arch to Dover, and that's 87 miles run. I don't know what that is in kilometres to you.
It's 140 kilometers running, then the channel, which is 33 kilometer plus minus, and then the 290 kilometer cycling.
Yeah, so 87 mile run, then the swim across the English Channel, and then 290 kilometers, about 180 miles cycle to Paris. So yeah, that's what I'm going to be attempting in September this year. So 300 miles in total. I'm looking at times, as is usual for me, and I met a guy and I trained with him in 2019, Chris Leake, who holds the current non-wetsuit record, and that's just under 70 hours. Not decided whether I'd like to beat that or not yet, but I'm trying to, 25 weeks into my training, got another 25 weeks to go, and Chris is a great guy. That was an amazing achievement, and I swam with him a bit in Dover in the past. I believe in setting myself targets, and it'd be nice to have that at the back of my mind, but we'll see.
When I first learned about you and this challenge, I was like, I didn't even believe this is possible. I was like, oh wow, this is incredible. So you said it's an official race, so there's a group that organizes this race, right?
Yeah, so Enduroman Arch to Arc is a black branded race now. So Edgar Etty, who was the first person to ever do that, he did that 22 years ago now. So in the 22 years that the event has existed, I think there's 55 people completed it, 6 of those without a wetsuit. So yeah, it takes up to about, I think, 10 people a year, 10 channel swim slots, and him and his small team help advise you on the training and then the routes and ultimately how to be successful. Earlier in the year, in January, I was at a training camp with them in Lanzarote and spent a week with Claire and Edgar and a number of other Arch to Arch aspirants. And it was the most amazing week. I've never done a training camp in my life. And getting to meet them both, learning about what a successful attempt looks like and also meeting the other aspirants and just spending a week with like-minded people. It was just amazing. So I go back and said to my wife, I want to go on a training camp every year now, irrespective of what race I'm doing.
Yeah, I told you before that I also am still wrapping up my training camp, but I'm also like, I've never done one before. And I'm also, I really want to do this with you, Bruno. We have to go together next year. It's cool because you focused the whole time on sports and recovery, and this is your main thing. And you're still very busy in doing that. So it's amazing.
Yeah, it's the first time in my life where I've even thought about what it would be like to be a professional athlete. So I said to you, growing up, I always did triathlon as a fun social thing. I never even considered sport as a career. And then I went to Loughborough University and I saw trained alongside some professional athletes. And even then, I didn't consider that was a path that I'd want to go down. So this Lanzarote camp was like the first time in my life where I was like, wait, all I've got to do every day is get up, eat, do 5 hours of training, and then relax, a bit of stretching, lounge around and sleep. And I was like, actually, this sounds like a good life.
I had the exact same thoughts this week.
I'm sure it's not as easy as that when you put it into week in, week out and the higher level. But yeah, I really enjoyed that as a first training camp.
I think for professionals, I played a lot of tennis growing up, consider going professional. So this is something I dabbled with when I was younger. And I think when you have this layer of that your future and your career depends on the sport, it comes different.
Yeah,
it's not as light and as enjoyable, I would say. At least it wasn't for me. Probably the ones that actually make it to the top do find a way to enjoy it. Otherwise, I think it's a little bit too intense, but I would assume it's a little bit harder. But anyways, I think this is a good segue to talk about your training. I really want to know, how do you prepare for such an event? Can you break down the discipline for us and tell us like your typical week right now, middle of the cycle, 25 weeks in, right? And then 25 weeks to go. Like, how many times do you run? How many times do you bike? How many times do you swim? Just give us a whole kind of holistic picture of what your training looks like.
Oh, wow. This may sound crazy, but I don't actually think about the training too much. So for the first time in my life, I've started working with a coach. Because how I've gradually built up with endurance sports over the years, it's always been a stepping stone to me. So I've never thought like I needed to pay a coach. And I learned from people around me. That might be people at the local triathlon club. There's good coaches at the local triathlon clubs. This year, for the first time, I started paying a coach and he's setting everything for me. So I tend not to think about exactly what I'm doing. I just know that it's probably two sessions a day, sometimes three. So I tend to load up training peaks and figure out which session I can do before work and which session I can do after work. So in terms of hours, I was hovering around 15 hours a week for much of the first 20 weeks. And then the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've been up more around 17 to 20. And I think this week's probably going to be about 22 hours. I'd say it's fairly evenly split amongst the three disciplines. This week marks the halfway point in my training schedule, so 25 weeks in. And so we did a little less in the week. And then the weekend started on Friday afternoon with a 58-kilometer run, 6.5-hour run on Friday afternoon. And then I woke up Saturday morning, and obviously my legs were tired Saturday morning. And then I looked again at my training plan, and I knew this already, but I put it to the back of my mind. He put me in a 10K run. So the 10K run on tired legs from 58K the day before. And that was a weird one because I went out running and I felt like I was running with wooden legs for the first few miles. And then I actually loosened off. So towards the end of the 10K, I felt reasonable. I wouldn't say I felt great, but I felt reasonable. And then I went straight to an outdoor Lido, which is not too far away from where I live. And the benefit of the Lido is that a Lido is an outdoor pool. And it's spring fed. It's 17 degrees Celsius all year round. So it's just got that added benefit that I'm also trying to get used to cooler temperatures, cooler than indoor pools. So I did a 10-kilometer swim on Saturday. And then today onto the bike. It was meant to be a six-hour bike outside, but the weather's absolutely atrocious today. So I've done a three-hour turbo so far today, and then I'll probably get back on the turbo again later this evening and do a bit more cycling.
Some crazy volume. How do you think your body is able to recover from all of these very long sessions back to back?
Stretching is something that I've been doing this year. So I was 40 at the back end of last year, and I've never done strength and conditioning training. I've never stretched in my life, not properly. So that's something that I've introduced. So I think that's really helped me. I could never see myself getting into that, but a lot of the time now, I started off with my coach setting me stretching routines, but then now I get YouTube on quite a lot of the time, and I found a few good people on YouTube and post run stretching, and I'll just do a 20-minute program. And a lot of it's about like how long you hold the stretch as well, because that seems to be, the longer you hold it, it might get more painful during the stretch, but then that gives you the benefit the next day. I think that type of thing, stretching, but then also I've been trying to work on my nutrition as well, because I've always just done sport as a way of partially excusing my lackadaisical attitude to what I eat and drink. So I like beer, I like wine, I like all the bad foods as well, pizza and burgers. So I've always used sport. Oh, I do lots of sport, so I can eat and drink what I want, up until this year. And I actually won in a raffle. It was a friend of mine has her own fitness company, and it was a load of fitness prizes as part of this raffle. And I won a session with a nutritionist. And again, that's something that I don't think I'd ever have gone to see a nutritionist, but because I won it as a prize, I went and said to her, I'm not going to stop drinking beer because I like beer. I like unhealthy food, but what changes can I make that are moderate that will improve my athletic performance? So I came out with quite a list of different things, and some of them I was actually like, oh, I'd stop. Like one of them was like eating yogurt with breakfast. So I love yogurt, but I stopped eating that. I tried to cut down on my breakfast to lose some weight. And she was like, no, you can load this up and eat these certain things with lots of fruit. And yeah, so I've gradually become a bit more healthy with my eating. And then with the stretching and the strength and conditioning, I think that's just meaning that I'm able to increase the volume of training up to these 20, 22-hour weeks without getting injured, touch wood.
I think when you do those very long endurance challenges, those rather overlook, I call it almost other disciplines, become more important, like recovery, stretching, and nutrition. And I actually do feel that as well in my Ironman training. Food is becoming more important. And also I do now stretch as well, because after a bike ride, I feel like I'm shorter. My tendons are all shorter, so I need to do the counter movement to make them long again, so I can do the next session the next day. So it definitely resonates with me as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the stretching, the nutrition, the sleep. Yeah, trying to sleep more, especially this weekend. With the hours that I've put in, I've slept. I can sleep sometimes up to 10 hours.
So when you have your weekly program, I assume you also have to train most of your trainings in the lower zones. Do you also do interval sessions, or is all fairly easy work?
I'd say probably like 70-80% of it is lower intensity stuff aimed at the event that I'm training for, so long distance. But then there are interval sessions. Haven't been doing so many on the running side, more because of the risk of injury with doing interval running. But on the cycling side, that's where I've been doing more interval works. And some of the sessions that my coach has set me just have been savage. I get to the end of one hour 15 on the bike. And sometimes on paper, it looks like it's an okay set. You look at it in the morning, you're like, that's not too bad. And then you know what it's like if you push it hard. I'm on a static bike. I could fall off the bike sideways at the end of the session. I'm that tired.
How do the sessions look like? Because I also do once a week interval on the bike, and I'm always a bit scared because it's so hard. Just getting this power out of your legs, it's hard for me.
Yeah, some of them are like under and over efforts, so they're not too bad. But it's the short, like high power efforts where I'm not as good, because I've done endurance sports for 30 years and I love the low intensity, long, slow efforts. That's what I enjoy. so I'm good at that. But the short, high power efforts, that's where it really hurts me. Yeah, they're not so good, not so fun, but I need to do more of them.
I can relate. Now, Paul, we've talked about preparation in terms of body preparation. Obviously, a huge aspect of this race that you're setting yourself to do is mental. How do you prepare mentally to take on such a long event that may place so many different challenges through such a long day?
So most sessions, when they get hard, I try to remind myself about the challenge that I'm going to be taking part in September. Trying to picture just in my own mind what success looks like. Think about arriving at the Arc de Triomphe. But yeah, I mean, most of the time I'm thinking about the end result is when I'm in pain during a training session. And if I'm honest, it's probably the fear of failure that drives me the most in those training sessions. So yeah, the run on Friday was just not enjoyable. I didn't feel good from start to finish, but all of the time just telling myself that this needs to get done. Otherwise, you're not going to make it to Paris next year. So yeah, I play mental games with myself like that, telling myself fear of failure, but then just picturing what success looks like and put a lot of preparation into this. And it's quite a large expense and it's a lot of family time where I'm missing time with my family. Just picturing what success looks like.
For me, sometimes when I have a hard session and I'm almost giving up, but then I'm kind of crossing this line and I'm like, no, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to finish this session. And then I actually do it. It's so rewarding, this feeling to know that you were struggling a lot mentally and then you still made it.
Yeah, exactly. So I have quite a few sessions like that where I'm struggling. It might be 60, 70% of the way through the session. And if you're on the bike, your quads are completely giving up, or in the pool, your shoulders and your arms are just aching. Sometimes I have those moment lapses where you might go easy for a rep or a little easier than you plan to do, and then try and pick it back up again and complete the session as planned.
Do you think that you're maybe built in a different way than other people to be able to do this? Because it's so hard to do. It's already hard to do an Ironman just by itself, but you're doing something that's really almost out of this world.
Yeah, I can't quite put my finger on what it is, but my wife says to me, yeah, you've built differently and mentally, being able to push through pain. So it's a bit strange because if it's self-inflicted pain, I'm good with that. But for example, like I don't like needles, I don't like an injection. So if it's somebody inflicting pain on me, I'm not happy. But with an endurance sport, you're always in control, in my opinion. It might be hurt and you can always ease off a bit and go at a lower intensity. So I think I've just built up that skill over 30 years of having a long, sustained effort at a level that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, I guess I can imagine that. Since you started at 9, that must help. Like we know with endurance sports, it builds over time. You cannot get to a certain level just overnight. It takes many years of consistent training. And I think the fact that you've done Ironmans and many marathons and have done it since a kid doesn't explain that you're able to do it, but I'm sure is a prerequisite in a way. You can't just wake up one day and do this kind of thing.
Yeah, I do believe that you become accustomed to these things over many years. For example, I can't sprint. So when I'm at the local triathlon club training in the pool, everybody knows if we're doing longer reps that I'll go to the front. But then if we go to 50-meter or 100-meter sprint, it's probably the difference between slow twitch and fast twitch muscle fibers. And I can't really sprint that well just because I've come accustomed to doing long, slow efforts. So that is something that I'm now working into my sessions, trying to do more sprint work to build that top end speed.
What is the distance that you feel you can go for in swimming, running and cycling that feels, oh, up until this distance, I don't really feel tired and I don't really need to recover? Like how long do you think you can go in each discipline?
At the moment, like so swimming, I'd say 5K. Well, one of my favorite swim sessions at the moment is 10 times 400. So that's quite just a steady swim session for me, trying to hit 6 minutes for all of the 400s. I don't feel too bad after those types of sessions. So 4 or 5K in the pool. Cycling is my weakness. So after 50, 60 miles, 100 kilometers, at the moment, that's when it starts to feel uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable more than my legs being tired. I'm just getting used to the long time in that position. That will come. And then running wise, funnily enough, I've got used to at the moment running marathons in training. So there's a 3 or 4 week period where most of my training runs, I should say run walks, were of a marathon kind of distance. So I've been doing a lot of 15-minute run, 5-minute walks, just to keep the intensity very low. And then also the 5-minute walks allow me to take on liquid and food. I've been doing a lot of marathons at that kind of pace and finishing in 4 hours, 24 and a half hours, which actually my first London marathon was a 4 hours, 22. So now I'm doing a run walk marathon at the same pace I used to do a marathon at, which is amazing.
Wow. And I guess in the challenge itself, you also, I assume you're always going to do a bit like of running and walking as a planned thing to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, 87 miles on foot is going to hurt and going to tire me out. But you've got to manage it because I've got to get to Dover in a fit enough state to try and swim the English Channel the following day. So currently working on the basis that probably the run could take 18, maybe 20 hours. And then the swim might be 15 hours. So I can't completely destroy myself on that run. So it's got to be a mixture of run, walk, keeping the heart rate low and eating and drinking as much as possible.
When you will get to the south of the UK, how much time are you allowed to take a break between the end of the run and the start of your swim? So your T1, so to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it might be a day. But I'm not going to take that long. I'm probably working on the basis of, we're still debating it with my coach, and it depends how fit I get and how little sleep I think I can have. But working on the basis of set off for the Channel swim 28 to 30 hours before the swim. So, for example, if it took me 20 hours to run there, then I'd have 8 hours rest before starting the Channel swim.
When you get to France, is your bicycle going to be there at the beach and somebody's waiting for you? How does that look like?
Oh, man, it's a logistical nightmare in itself. So you've got to have 3 separate support teams. So I'll have a support team on the run with me and they'll be in a car. Then there's a support team on the bow, and then there'll be a 3rd support team who take the Channel Tunnel and they'll meet me in Calais with my bike or maybe a couple of bikes. I will land on a beach somewhere in northern France. And then I'll have to get back onto the bow, and then you have to go into France via customs at Calais. So there's a time element there as well, where it may take you an hour or two to get to Calais and through customs until you can meet your third party support team with your bike and probably get a shower because you've got a lot of grease on you and you're very salty. So probably need a hotel to get a quick shower. We'll probably need some level of sleep. I haven't worked out how much that will be. And then jump on a bike for a 180-mile, 290-kilometer cycle.
Which part of this event are you most excited about?
I'm excited about the finish because I picture the finish quite a lot. As I was saying in my training, when I'm in pain, I think about the finish. But actually swimming the Channel again, swimming in the sea is my love, my main passion. So I'm really excited about swimming the English Channel again. 87 miles, though, the run is the scariest bit for me. That's more scary than the swimming the Channel, just because I've never run that far on foot. The furthest I've ran was about 70 miles and I couldn't walk the following day. So this is an 87-mile run, but I've got to do that 87 miles and be in a fit state. That's the bit that scares me.
Yeah, and you're not allowed to use a pool boy after in the Channel, right?
No, exactly. So yesterday when I'd done my long run and then I jumped in the pool, I actually took my pool boy with me, thinking exactly that. I was thinking I'm going to use my pool boy and keep my legs in the air. And then I thought to myself, that's cheating, don't do it. So I did. I swam the 10K yesterday and my pool boy just stayed on the side of the pool and I didn't use it. But it's just learning just to have a gentle kick that relaxes your leg without your legs are tired from the run. But I've not got a powerful kick in the swim.
Fascinating.
I would like to ask about your coach, because you said you have a coach for the first time in your life. And what is his or her experience with such a race? Has this person done the race or coached already people who have done such races? And how has this relationship affected your training and change the way you train?
So I need to give a shout out to my coach, JC, John Cowell. And one of the reasons why I picked him was I knew him through some friends of mine, Holly and Mel, and he'd helped them with a challenge that they'd done, the Lakes to London. And he also had experience with Enduroman Arch to Arc in the past. So he trained somebody a couple of years ago to do this exact event. So that was probably the most important thing for me, that he knew how this was going to be possible. Because at the time that I signed up, obviously I was very passionate about doing the race, but I had no idea really how to train for this. So the key thing for me was, I actually met him in the pub 18 months ago, and people sat around and must have just thought, what the hell are these two guys talking about? Running 87 miles swimming the channel. And my main question to him was, how can I get fit enough to run 87 miles and still be in good enough shape to swim the channel? And he reassured me. This was before we even had a professional relationship. He just reassured me, chatting over a beer, that it was possible, and with my background, we could do it. So we had a couple of meetings like that where we met for beer and a curry, and I just became aware that, yeah, this is the guy to train me up to do this.
Are there some things that stood out to you that he told you that you were like, this is something that I would have never thought about, or something that surprised you in his approach?
Quite scientific approach. He's just turned 60, he's studying for a PhD in the sports-related field, which I absolutely love, that kind of scientific approach to training. I'm very good at having a social, fun attitude to training, so I needed somebody who was different to me. I've got other friends that are coaches who I have a lot of fun with, but I just thought, this year I need to be a serious athlete. So his approach, the fact that he was still studying and willing to learn. So it wasn't really one particular thing he said to me. It was just that I got a reassurance from his background, the people he coached over many years, and a long list of qualifications, that he's serious scientific approach. I like a bit too much fun sometimes, so we can probably complement each other in this challenge.
Interesting.
Makes sense. Did you feel your training has changed a lot since you started with him?
Yeah, there's some approaches. Some of the sessions are completely different to what I do when I was just setting myself training sessions. Particularly, I mentioned earlier on the turbo, on the bike. Turbo is something that I don't really enjoy, but he's had me do some really savage sessions, which I think for raising my FTP, I don't ask questions about why the hell am I doing it. I just do them. And so, yeah, biking's been different. The running has been a little different as well. Probably that 15-minute run, 5-minute walk approach has been down to JC. And then other things like travel a bit with work. So I was traveling to India on business last November. And what I typically do before I travel on business is I'd absolutely cane myself into the ground the week before. I'd do as much as humanly possible and then jump on the plane, barely being able to walk. And he said to me, no, that's not the approach we're taking here. At that stage, we were only like 10 weeks into a 50-week program. Just that wise man attitude of, we don't need to be doing this now. We don't need to be taking those risks. You're only going to get ill. So there's little things like that where I do certain things differently and probably push myself too hard at certain points of times, whereas he's got us on a gradual, my fitness is increasing, but it's increasing at a nice gradual rate. My old approach would have been like the boom and bust strategy. Some massive weeks where you'd probably do 25, 30 hours. I've done that in marathon training in the past as well. Not 25, 30 hours, but do huge weeks. And then the following week you drop off. I think the older I get, the wiser I get, there's more consistency. And we're definitely banging out the weeks consistently at the moment. And it tends to be three or four weeks on, and then one easy week, and next week's an easy week that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, that sounds more reasonable. I find it funny that this is often the case. I coach, so I feel like there's two different types of athletes. There are athletes that need a coach so that there's somebody looking over, that then they feel like they have to do the training. I feel like this is the people that probably not that so much into running or training in general, and they just need something to keep them going, and that's one kind of coaching. And then you have the folks that are super into it And then usually my job is really, hey, don't do this now. Take a step back. Don't run. Yeah. Get some more rest. It's funny. It becomes very clear from 2 weeks on what kind of athlete you are. I know which kind you are.
Yeah, exactly that. And like last weekend, he'd put me a solid plan together and I went not a bit above. I went way beyond what he'd set me. And it's funny because I still make those mistakes now and again. And normally it's the social aspect. So I went running with a friend. I was meant to do an hour and 50 run. I did a 3.5 hour run. And then I went cycling with a friend on Sunday. I think I had in my plan 3 or 4 hours and I went out for 7 hours. I went way over the plan. And he doesn't tell me off or anything, but we exchange a few messages and Monday and Tuesday might go by okay and my legs don't feel too bad. And then what tends to happen is I think I've got away with it. And then it comes to Wednesday and I just all of a sudden I'm like, oh no, what did I do? He was right again.
I feel you for that. Naturally, I'm somebody who always wants to push and, oh, I can do more and I feel good. Why can I not do more? But I also learned now with my coach to follow the training blindly, not do more, and just trust the process and trust his planning and big picture view.
Yeah.
But it's hard sometimes.
I certainly need to do more of that, Fabi. Just follow what's set and don't do too much too different. Because things are going to plan 25 weeks in and it's going so far.
Have you had some changes in your body type or also some changes that you noticed during those 25 first weeks?
So I'm quite heavy for a triathlete. I'm 93 kilos. Lends itself well to open water swimming without a wetsuit more than it does to long distance running. I've noticed that I've toned up a bit, but I haven't lost a lot of weight. And I discussed that with my coach. Part of me wants to lose weight, but then part of me knows that risk getting cold during the channel swim. So I'm eating a lot, as much as I really can. So at the moment, the main change has been that I've toned up. My fat percentage has come down on the scales. But other than that, my weight's fairly stable.
I think it's fascinating to hear you've done all these races and you've done them consistently throughout your life, besides also studying, working, having a family and being a very social person. I think it's one of those things that you're like, how does one do it? So I'm very curious to hear your strategies for how do you make this all work. I think it's the big question mark for most people that want to get into endurance sports or just being more active in general, and they don't really know how to make it all work. So I think you must have some secrets to share.
Yeah, that's one of probably the biggest topics, like in the office and with friends at the tri clubs now, is like, how the heck do you fit all of this exercise in, bringing up 2 kids and working a full-time job? And I think for me, it's like being flexible around when you train and just setting the routine. So I try to convince people at work who don't do enough sport that they can fit it in. So for me, I've got a very sporty family. My daughters do swimming. We do gymnastics, tennis, volleyball. So I try to fit a lot of my sport in either in the morning or later in the evening. But also when I'm dropping them at the various clubs, some Saturdays I drop my older daughter at a volleyball session and I've got an hour and a half there. As soon as I drop her, I'm in my running kit ready and I'll go for a run. And the same with my other daughter at gymnastics. So I think it's just about trying to plan your weeks out. And often on a Monday morning, the first thing when me and my wife wake up, and she'll ask me, what's in your training plan this week? And we'll talk through the week and I'll say what sessions I've got. And she's sporty as well. She swims and runs. So we try and work out when both of us are going to fit in our exercise for the week so that at least it feels hectic, but it is balanced and we're all getting in our exercise, the four of us.
Yeah, I think you have to be a bit creative with planning your workouts and being also structured in this at the same time, knowing when your partner has time for the children and when you can go to the pool. Running is a bit easier because you can always run, right?
Sure. Yeah, I always think running's the easiest thing to fit in. Swimming, you've got to find a pool time and you've got to try and fit that in around everything. But you can always have a pair of trainers on and the pavements are free for the moment. But yeah, the other time I try and fit in training is in the commute to work. So I have about a 17, 18 mile commute. So that's 30 kilometers ish. So that's a nice cycle ride, 1 hour ish each way. And I'm very lucky because my company are based, the facility that I'm based at just outside of Derby, it's a very rural setting. So the route to get to my work is not busy roads, it's country roads, rolling hills. And it's just, yes, when I do that as a commute and cycle, it's such a great feeling getting to work. And then you really do feel alive in the morning. It sets up the day.
Do you commute to work on your bike nearly every day?
No. So since COVID, I've been more home-based. So we're 50-50 at home and in the office. It takes a bit of planning, dropping trousers and everything that you need and a towel. But we've got good shower facilities there. But what I tend to try and do is leave stuff there on later in the week, on a Thursday and Friday. And then at least I got into a routine a little while ago of doing every Monday training for the event that I'm doing. I was actually cycling to work, leaving my bike at work and then running home. So that was, an hour cycle in the morning and then a 2.5 hour run home. So a good start to the week on a Monday, 3.5 hours of exercise.
Yeah, that's more than people do in a week, most people.
Paul, I would love to switch gears and talk about your big support system that you have in your life, which is obviously your wife, who's also super into sports and is there always with you and in all the races, and your children. Can you share with us how important it is for you to have such a system around you and how that makes it all more fun and more enjoyable? Or what does that mean to you?
Yeah, it is amazing just having the family of four of us that just all love sports so much, and we just all encourage each other. They're not all sports that I'm into myself. Like my youngest daughter does a gymnastics. I've never done gymnastics, neither has my wife. But she does pushing 20 hours a week of gymnastics training and does that national level. And we just all support her and we know it's what she loves. She's there today doing her little gymnastics competition. And then my older daughter, she's a bit more like me. She likes doing lots of different sports, but more of the social element. So she's done everything over the years, done tennis, gymnastics, swimming. She's tried triathlon as well. And then my wife was a really good competitive swimmer. Her PB for 400 meter freestyles are 4:20, which is a minute faster than me. So she swam at a national level as a junior as well. And she still enjoys swimming and running. So the whole family like doing lots of different sports. And that's the main challenge in the week, is how can we all fit in what we love doing? And it's in different places around Derby and Nottingham. And how can we divvy up the week? And often I'm taking my older daughter and driving one direction, and my wife's taking my younger daughter and driving a different direction to a different club. And then we meet back home in the evenings and have dinner and compare notes on what we've all done. So it's just great family environment where we all love sport.
That's very special and very cute that you have this in your family and you can share your successes and your all your biggest fans. That's really amazing.
Yeah, and they've come to watch me do runs and triathlons from a young age as well. So I think that'll have an impact on them in the long run. I've got some really cute photos from when the two girls were probably like 3 and 5, stood at the side of a marathon course, like waving a little sign. And it's cute to look back on those things.
How is your wife supporting you? Your sport takes up a lot of space, even though she also is very active. How does she support you, and also with the children, and how does that work? Because I assume also when you signed up for the challenge, you would ask her before committing to it and not just saying I'm doing this.
I spent quite some years convincing her that this was something that I could do. So I guess luckily I didn't get a place for the first few years because she wasn't convinced. But I think as the years have gone on and I've done more endurance races, she eventually realized that this is something that I really wanted to do after several years and said, okay, I'll support you on it. So then in terms of like day to day, how does she support? She's great getting the kids to school and picking them up. And if there's one of us that's doing more sport, which is more often myself, she'll take one for the team and get the food in that we need. And she's just very accommodating, making lots of time for me to train and stuff and organising the kids with their activities. So I really appreciate it.
It's so important to have somebody next to you that is there for you and making the sacrifices that sometimes are needed.
Cool. So there's a good for also the listeners to hear. You can have a career, have children and a partner, and have a hobby passion that's time consuming.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing is I don't like exercising at lunch so much, because when I'm in the office, I like to go for lunch with the team. But that's another option if I can't fit my two sessions in the morning and the evening. Especially if you can find like-minded individuals at work. I work in a rural setting, and there's quite a lot of people who are into the fitness. And there's been times in the past where there's a little group of us gone out for a half an hour run, and then they use the showers and facilities at work to get changed. So it's about finding opportunities like that where you can fit even half an hour's exercise just into the start, middle, or end of your day. And when you start making it part of the routine, and you start enjoying it, that's when you can do more of it and reap the rewards of that fitness.
Is there one advice, like a top advice, that you would give to the listeners who have a full-time job and regular lives and are asking themselves if they would like to get into more endurance sports and be more active? What would you tell them if you could only say one thing to give them that advice?
That's tough. It seems so obvious to say this, but just find something you enjoy. I don't care whether it's triathlon, just find a sport or a hobby that you enjoy and you're passionate about. And then don't make excuses. You make time in your calendar, even if it's just half an hour, to fit that in two or three times a week and just get into that routine. But it's got to be something you enjoy. I see some people get talked into doing sports that maybe aren't for them and led a little astray. You've got to find something that you truly enjoy.
For sure. Then it shouldn't feel like you're dragging yourself to the pool or running, cycling, right? You really should be like, oh, I'm excited to do this.
Yeah, like a marathon. People always think about a marathon as the holy grail of running. And a marathon just isn't for some people. There's so many weeks of training that if you don't like running, or you're just running 5Ks and anything beyond that's painful, just keep enjoying 5Ks, maybe do a 10K. You don't have to push yourself just because other people are pushing the distances.
Now we have some fire questions for you. So these are, you cannot think too much, just answer whatever comes top of your mind and we'll go from there. Okay. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. What's your favorite post-workout meal or snack?
Oh, it depends if I'm being good or bad. If I'm being bad, it's a pizza. If I'm being good and I'm listening to nutritionist advice, it's something more like a stir fry with lots of veg in there and some prawns.
Okay, next question. Breaststroke or backstroke?
Oh, backstroke. I think the people at the local swimming baths know that. I always like to cool down doing backstroke. I just think it's a good way to cool down after a long session of front crawl.
You have to teach me because I'm so bad at the backstroke. Always when my coach tells me now do some recovery backstroke, I always hit the side thingies in the pool and then I'm like, okay, I'm going to turn around.
Oh, I think backstroke's great for a cool down after front crawl.
Yeah, if you know how to do it.
Keep trying.
If you could swim anywhere in the world, where would it be?
Oh, man. It's got to be somewhere exotic. Like, I've never been to the Maldives. That looks pretty cool.
Do you have any essential gear or equipment that you cannot do your triathlons without? Obviously the bike excluded.
Essential gear. Because I told you I was a bit heavier than your average triathlete. I need some like cycling shorts to wear underneath my running shorts to stop my thighs from rubbing.
Nice.
They're essential. A friend of mine at work calls it chub rub.
Keeps you from shaving. That is essential for sure. Do you run with or without music?
Oh, definitely without music. I just like to listen to the sound of nature and, yeah, no music for me.
And if you could go for a run with anyone living or a historical figure, who would it be and why?
I'm not sure about running. I need to give that more thought. Swimming, though, Sarah Thomas. I'd like to go for a swim with Sarah Thomas. You've heard of her? She was the lady who did the four-way crossing of the English Channel and set a record. It was something crazy like 120 kilometers swimming over, I don't know how many hours.
We arrived at the end of all of our questions. Thank you so much, Paul, for your time. And it was super interesting learning more about your journey in triathlon for so many years and hearing more about your challenge.
Cool. Thank you both very much. I really enjoyed that.
It was amazing, Paul. I'm fascinated by your ability to push through and be able to complete these insane events. I wish you a lot of luck in your next thing, and I hope that you can keep doing this for many more years to come and enjoy it with your family.
Thank you both. Yeah, I've really enjoyed talking to you both today, and it's only 25 weeks to go, and I keep telling myself that, and it doesn't seem that long now to get ready for this challenge. So I'm excited about the year ahead.
Yeah, we're definitely gonna follow your journey along.
Cool, thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into Human Endurance. We hope you enjoyed this episode and felt inspired by Paul's story. If you liked the show, don't forget to rate it and hit the subscribe button. This helps us to reach a bigger audience and to get other humans to hear the inspiring stories we have to share. In fact, if you know of someone who would enjoy listening to Paul's story, go ahead and share the episode with them. Thank you, and see you next time.